The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Come try new Skyline Dip Cholitos at your neighborhood Skyline today. A warm, soft tortilla filled with their amazing chili and cheese with an extra layer of cream cheese and crunchy Fritos corn chips. At participating Skyline restaurants for a limited time.
Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners. Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele, and that's Rachel Maddow.
I'm Rachel Maddow. Hello.
That's Rachel Maddow. And the book, which is a humdinger, as my dad used to say a lot when I was young, and I don't know why, but it always sort of got my attention. Prequel, An American Fight Against Fascism. It is an amazing book, and it details, chronicles the emergence of fascism in the late 30s and the 40s. But now I want to talk about the heroes, because you go through and you lay out the cast of characters, and we've talked about a number of them, including before we went to break, Henry Ford of that Ford. Talk to us about the folks who you really titled the book after.
The good those guys, who fought.
Those Americans who were fighting against this rise of fascism.
One of the interesting things to me about the whole sort of memory holing of this story, the fact that we don't remember much of it, is that there are some of the bad guys whose names have survived. Charles Coughlin, Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, there is maybe only one of the good guys whose name has survived. Everybody else totally lost to history. Some of them, the people who are the biggest heroes in this fight in the late 30s and early 40s, they in some ways saved the country, did incredible work, and yet their work wasn't even recognized in their own lifetimes. It wasn't even mentioned in their own obituaries when they finally moved on. But there's one who is a name that maybe some people listening to us right now might know, and it is Eric Severide. Does that name mean anything?
It means a lot, yeah.
So the famous CBS News
I grew up with Eric.
Eric Severide was a huge deal in 20th century American broadcasting. He was a big, very big deal on CBS. Before he was Eric Severide, he was Arnold Severide, which was actually his first name. His middle name was Eric. And he was a Cub reporter in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. And he was trying to get his first front page story. And he had heard that there was something weird, kind of sort of occult spiritualist, but also conspiratorial, really radical thing going on in middle-class and upper-middle-class houses in Minneapolis. He had just heard through the grapevine that there was some kind of a cult thing going on in middle-class homes. And so he decided, as a white guy, as a young, upstanding, sort of strapping Protestant guy, he would get himself invited into these secret societies. And he did an undercover operation where he exposed a group called the Silver Shirts. And the Silver Shirts were founded by a guy named William Dudley Pelley. He wanted to be the Adolf Hitler of America. He founded the Silver Shirts the day Hitler became Chancellor.
Yeah, because that's a job everybody should apply for.
Yeah, exactly. You got to really get your LinkedIn together for that. We're going to go for that one. But he had this, he was a charismatic guy. He'd actually been a Hollywood screenwriter. He knew sort of how to move people. And he ended up organizing Americans into like tens of thousands of people into this fascist cult where they were armed. They were rabidly anti-Semitic. They were not only armed in a private sense, they were stockpiling weapons in armories. They were working with active duty U.S. military and National Guardsmen to steal from U.S. armories. And they were plotting the violent overthrow of the U.S. government to install their leader as the fascist dictator. And Severide went undercover and exposed them in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, in a way that was really the first big reporting of his career. And it dovetailed with other exposés that other really intrepid undercover reporters were doing around that time. And it ended up sort of exposing this thing to the public and also crucially exposing this thing to the Department of Justice. The mm-hmm. Justice Department found out about the nature of these threats and how violent these groups were, in part through journalists infiltrating them, being very brave, infiltrating armed groups, right? That's a scary thing to do undercover, and exposing them. That's part of how law enforcement finally cottoned to the threat of these groups.
It's taking that singular action. You hear something. It's almost like the you hear something, say something, see mm-hmm. something. Yeah. And you realize just how much of a fine line that is between the good guys actually being in a position to do something and the bad stuff continuing.
Yeah.
Because it's always these one-off things. You look at, talking about this idea of Americans sort of having this sense of whatever that moves them into this space. And I guess you're right when you say we can't give up on them. Because if the Eric Severides just didn't follow the story or just kind of say, well, they're just pissed off people. They're
unreachable.
Look, they're in Minnesota, for God's sake. And it's, the dead of winter. Of course, they're going to get into witchcraft,
That still applies today, by the way. Anybody still listening to us in Minneapolis, we know what you're up to.
So you do kind of. These heroes, in one sense, you kind of understand why their storylines aren't as remarkable as the people they're fighting against or they're writing about, because
it's about standing up for what's right.
Right.
Here's another example. So there's this senator who I was saying to somebody the other day, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out something good to say about the senator. I'm sure there was something good about him. I'm sure he was a good little league coach or something. I have yet to find a good thing about him. But it was a senator, coincidentally, also from Minnesota. And he was a jerk. And I say that because one of the things he was doing was he was stealing from his staff. When his Senate staff would get paid every week, he would force them to hand over a portion of their salary back to him in cash as a kickback. That's what it took to be on his Senate staff. Like a real winner.
Wow.
But there was a secretary who was working for him who was in that kind of an employment relationship with him. So she was that powerless in that office. This was not somebody who was like signing up to be a paratrooper. This was like a low-level Senate staffer in a bad Senate office in a position with no power being exploited. And yet, her name was Phyllis Pocivio. Yet from that position of utter powerlessness, she found the strength of character to go to the FBI about her senator boss, not to narc on him about the kickbacks and all the rest of it, but to tell them that she believed he was working with a Nazi agent and his wife had taken the evidence out of the office and the FBI should know where that evidence is. And the bravery that it took to do that from that person who did not wake up that morning wanting to be a hero, who did not take a secretary job in a Senate office wanting to be a hero, but nevertheless, did something, went to the FBI that started an investigation that helped unravel that entire multi-million dollar huge Nazi plot. That is an American hero. And that, I don't want to forget her either.
Yeah. I guess the question then sort of unfolds around all of that. When you look at the trials that come out of this, and you reference and you talk about in the book. So the Great Sedition Trial of the 1940s, what happens? It just...
It does not end well.
It doesn't end well.
No.
So, Rachel, where's my hope?
Yeah. All right. So I got some hope for you. It's around the corner. You have to go with me on a walk.
Okay, let's walk.
So the Justice Department decides to try all these 29 defendants in the same courtroom all at once. 29 defendants, 26 defense lawyers, all the prosecutors, all the U.S. Marshals, every reporter in the country, everybody, all crammed into one courtroom in Washington at a time when there was no air conditioning. And they set off on this trial to prove that all of these groups that were working in various ways to overthrow the U.S. government and install Nazism here, they were not only involved in the same conspiracy, seditious conspiracy together, they were involved in a seditious conspiracy that included the Nazi government in Berlin, which was supporting a lot of these efforts. And they brought that case. It was bedlam in the courtroom. Yep. Seven months into it, the judge up and dies in the middle of the case. And the Justice Department, now they've got a mistrial because the judge is dead. They have to decide whether or not they're going to bring this case again, starting at day one after 7 months of a nightmare. And by this point, it is 1944. The war is starting to turn. The Allies are sort of advancing. The Justice Department doesn't really want a deal, but they do let the prosecutor in the case. In 1946, when the Justice Department is still thinking about whether they're going to bring this case again, they let him go over to Germany. And he interviews high-ranking Nazi government officials who are defendants in the war crimes trials. And they open up the German Foreign Office files to him. And he goes through and he says, listen, we were alleging in this courtroom in Washington that y'all were working with the Nazis. Now we can ask the Nazis, hey, were you working with these Americans? And they got confirmation from Nazis and Nazi defendants and from the files that in fact what they were alleging was true. And that Justice Department prosecutor brought the information back home and said, we need to tell the American public because right. there are two dozen members of Congress who are involved in this too. And the Attorney General and Harry Truman take one look at that list of two dozen members of Congress and they say, oh no, A, you're fired, and B, this report is going nowhere. It is going in a drawer and we are locking it up. And it didn't have to be that way. You know what I mean? Like, we
why do we do that? I mean, but because we can see parallels today. I mean, that is, I mean, you have a former president who's trying to become president so he can expunge the records of those January 6th insurrectionists.
Yep.
You've got, do we draw some parallels, for example, with the four Oath Keepers that were convicted for a seditious conspiracy? I mean, because you can't help but draw these same parallels, right? I mean,
yeah, I think it's a huge deal that these pro-Trump right-wing paramilitary groups were convicted of seditious conspiracy, because it's really hard to get a conviction on that charge, right? If you're on trial, if the government has put you on trial for trying to overthrow the government, well, that means it didn't work. Because right. there's a government to put you on trial.
Right.
And so
right.
you can always right. say like, oh, it was never
funny how
happen.
That works out. Right. Yeah.
So so the fact that they were able to get those convictions, and they didn't put all the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys on trial together in one courtroom in Washington with or without air conditioning. They broke it down into groups of four, groups of five, and they got convictions in trial after trial after trial. That shows progress. Even though they fired the prosecutor, my guy, back in 1946 and submarined his report, he stayed at it doggedly for 15 years until the Justice Department allowed him to publish it in 1961 when nobody cared, but I dug it up. And now I'm able to tell this story now and put it in this book so we can learn from it now. There's these forgotten heroes who knew that America needed to hear the truth, who were never rewarded for it in their own lifetime, but they sacrificed and worked and opposed these people and exposed them, and we can benefit from it now.
What does it say that we're continually, and this is a stark example of it, and we have examples right now, continually protecting the congressional asses that are at the heart of a lot of this bad stuff, these members of Congress? Those individuals should have been exposed real time in the moment, just like in what we've seen from the Mueller investigation, what we've seen from the impeachment stories, and what we see now from the January 6th committee. When, I'm sorry, Jim Jordan says, well, I just don't recognize your subpoena. Nah, bitch, you got to come in. I mean, what is it that about us, the American people, who are presumably, last time I read the Constitution, the government, right? Of by for, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What is it about us that we don't hold these individuals accountable? And just because they're a member of Congress, because that's in my view, having been in some of these spaces and know them well, that's rife for the corruption. That's rife for you know, why we have a Foreign Registration Act. Because that's that. If I'm going to go someplace and sort of start chipping at America, I'm going to start with a member of Congress today. Yeah.
And I'll, I mean, not to be nerding out too bad here, but the first ever successful prosecution under the Foreign Agent Registration Act was a guy who ran the America First Committee chapter in Ohio, who in fact was on the payroll of the Nazis. But that's they brought that statute into effect and started using it then for the last time we were dealing with this sort of thing that involved a hostile foreign power trying to undermine us. I mean, when you say like, what is it about us that means that we don't hold these people to account? I feel like my only, like my hopeful rejoinder to that is that I feel like that story is not finished yet. Mm-hmm. You know, 2022 was a little bit of a test of that. And no, not everybody who was aiding and abetting what happened on January 6th got voted out, but the Trump endorsed MAGA candidates all over the country who were favored to be taking over and that what was supposed to be the big red wave, there was no red wave. And Trump endorsed candidates all over the country lost races that they were otherwise expected to win. Same thing happened with my guys in the 40s. Some of the members of Congress who were household names, super influential, super powerful, super well-connected, who were tied up in this ultra-right, anti-democratic, pro-Nazi plot in Congress, they were people who were like 24 years in the House, you know, 24 years in the Senate, like, or 22 years in the Senate, like people who had had huge careers who thought they could never, ever be voted out. And when this stuff was exposed in 42, 43, 44, they got voted out. Even the ones who were thought of as presidential timber, even honestly, President Truman's best friend from the Senate, even though a New York congressman who'd been there for 24 years, who was seen as an institution from one of the most prominent political families in the country, they were all voted out once the voters learned about their links to these plots. And it's not over. You know what I mean? Accountability is still a live question, I think, for us today. And it's the imperative, I think, behind why there still needs to be good journalism and good activism, good fact-finding, good prosecution in some cases, to make sure all the facts are known.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.